Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. And if you hear his voice, then this voice is not far behind it, and it belongs to the head chef of All Marine Radio. Kim, what's going on? Happy Friday. How are you doing?
Happy Friday to you, Mac. I'm doing great. This song just picks me up every time I hear it, and I hope that all you out there become Van Morrison fans like we are. Behind Bruce, of course.
You could be fans of both. No, we were talking last week. It's a happy song.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. You need to give a shout out to a guy named Bob Nielsen. He's a huge fan of yours. You've never met him. He lives in Annapolis. And he was recognized. Well, he's the godfather of All Marine Radio. If it weren't for Bob, I would not be still doing this. Which is pretty cool. He's been a veteran Marine who's been helping people since the Vietnam War. And he was honored by the Congressional Medal of Honor Society yesterday. So you should give him a little love there, Kimmy.
Bobby, congratulations. I hope you run into my sister out there. She works for the Board of Higher Ed for the state of Maryland in downtown Annapolis. And she loves Annapolis. Boy, that would be cool if you guys could say hey to each other.
Well, maybe
it's my sister, Casey.
We'll all get together when Patrick gets married next August.
That's a good call.
In Annapolis.
Yeah, that's a fun town, boy.
It's a pretty place.
I loved Annapolis when I was growing up.
Especially if you like crab.
Especially if you like crab, and especially if your uncle went to the Naval Academy, and he was an All-American lacrosse player for Annapolis.
Really?
And yeah, really, 2 years. And I go to the games, and they have an obstacle course around the field there that I guess I was 6 years old, and I used to try and and climb those big ropes and stuff, always with a little assistance from my uncle. But, Annapolis is a very, very cool town, and the Naval Academy is a great place.
Well, he's one.
Anyway, enough advertisement for Annapolis.
No, he's one of the cool guys in Annapolis, and was honored really for a lifetime of work devoted to veterans. Over 3,000 visits to Walter Reed. Raising a ton of money for different veteran causes. Started an organization called the 100 Entrepreneur Project, encouraging veterans to start businesses. And then he's the benefactor of All Marine Radio. And so all these different people that have had their lives touched by the ideas in post-traumatic winning, all that gets laid at his feet. So anyway, but he's a huge fan of yours. Yeah, oh my God.
Welcome to the show, baby.
Oh my God. He goes off on the stuff you say, and I'm like, all right, first of all, let's dial it down a little bit. You don't know him. He ain't all that. And he's like,
yeah.
Exactly. I'm like, let's just back away from the chef right now. And, no, he loves, and he, hey, all your recipes?
Yes.
Oh, he cooks them, man.
That is huge. And I hope he cooks the prime rib recipe. That's a killer recipe. And he'll be a winner, a prime rib dinner every time he cooks it. And, yeah, that's very, very cool. And I'm glad he listens because, he's a big part of, this show and, what he's brought to the table.
Oh, man.
For you. Yeah. It's huge. Absolutely huge. And I'm honored to, have him as a fan.
Yeah, no, let me tell you, he loves it and he cooks it. Yeah, and then I get the email. Well, actually, I should give him your phone number so you can he can talk to you, and then you can cut out the middleman and your little love fest you guys got going. So
I'm looking forward to it.
But again, the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, when you are the recipient of an award from them. That is not a society with a low bar to get over. Just so everybody knows, they have moderately lofty standards. So anyway,
you think?
Yeah, they've been around it a little bit. So tell me about any. I was in Colorado Springs this week.
Oh, were you? How did that go at the Air Force Academy?
It was awesome. I did it. The guy who introduced it, you know, Jacques Lamoureux, Captain Lamoureux.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. I get ready to introduce Jacques, Captain Lamoureux, right? And I said, well, let me tell you, I first met Jacques when he was like 12 years old. I saw him playing ice hockey, and he was clearly better, head and shoulders better than everybody else on the ice. And I said, who's that kid? And they said, oh, that's Jacques Lamoureux. I said, whoa. So now we moved to Grand Forks, and Patrick comes home from the ice rink one night, the outdoor rink one night, right? And he's limping. So I get home from work. He's limping around the house. I said, what happened to you? He said, oh, I playing hockey at the park. I said, okay. I said, well, what happened? He said, I got slashed. And he's limping good, right? I said, who slashed you? He said, Jacques. Now, Jacques's like 3 years older than Patrick. Jacques's like 12. Patrick's like 9. I said, what the hell? I said, what'd you do? He said, well, he was going down the ice. And Patrick's not a fast skater. He said, and he's kind of slowed down to make a move, and I was coming up behind him. I said, yeah. And he said, so I, from behind, I popped the blade of his stick up, took the puck, and curled and went the other way. And I said, okay. Then what happened? He said, well, I'm not exactly sure, but I thought he hacked my leg off. I said, and then what happened? He said, well, he took the puck back, and then he just went the other way. I said, you know, there's a lesson in that, Patrick. And he looked at me and goes, what? I said, don't take the puck from Jacques. He's not right in the head. So anyway, I tell this story. And then you'll get a kick out of this. So then, you know, Jacques does his thing. And he was awesome. He talked about, and, you know, Kim, you know, being from Grand Forks, Kim and I, you know, all, I think, like the community, there was a story that got written when Jacques was maybe 16 or 17. He's one of the best high school hockey players in the region. Okay.
Yes.
And he came out and talked about his struggle with depression. And I remember reading the article going, holy shit, man. You know, here you think you know a kid and no idea that Jacques struggled with that. And he's been very public about it. He's supported other people. His story has helped other people. And and then, as the story goes, was denied an initial admission to the Air Force Academy because of it. And then subsequently was admitted, and he's gone on to do good things. The And so, anyway, so a picture of Patrick pops up during the presentation. So I'm doing my thing, blah, blah, blah. I said, and that's my son Patrick. And then Jacques sitting out in the audience, right, in the front row. I said, the one Jacques tried to take his leg off, that's him. And then there was another picture that came up of Patrick a few minutes later. And I said, that's Patrick again. I said, oh, I said he's Captain Lammer, by the way, not Jock. So then in the commanding officer's closing comments, he stands up and he looks at Jock and he says, first of all, Captain Lammer, I just want to thank you for your courage in standing up here and tell you that, you know, we are all so proud of you. He said, well, not for the part where you tried to hack off Patrick's leg. He said, but for your courage in sharing your story. And so afterwards, Jacques and I are talking, looks at me, he goes, that was awesome. That was awesome. He goes, I'm never going to live that down now, am I? I said, hey, man, you got to be accountable. He says, what's the statute of limitations for a slash at Lions Park from 1990 from 1998? I said, well, it's obviously longer than 21 years. No, he's doing great. He's an instructor at the Air Force Academy, and I got a chance to meet his wife, and they have a son, another baby on the way, and they got a beautiful home there, and that they built. So Jock's doing great. You know, and it was really cool. I'm sitting there watching him talk, right? And I go back to the first, he was a little kid when I met him. And now he's a grown ass man and, two Grand Forks dudes, man, doing good stuff. So I was really proud of that too. And so was he. And I looked at him and I said, who knew, man? And he starts laughing. He goes, I know, isn't this crazy? And he said, but Mike, he said, this is awesome. He said, this is really awesome. This is really good. And yeah, I'm really excited to be a part of it. So
that is so cool.
Yeah, Grand G-Funk, North Dakota, man.
And, G-Funk. Yeah. And you still have the picture I sent you of the Lamoureux family, correct?
Well, I've got
on the ice sheet.
I've got a bunch
behind their house.
Oh, the one that was in Sports Illustrated?
Yes,
yeah. For those of you who don't know, the Flying Lammerer family. I met their dad, Pierre, who's kind of a gruff guy, right? And which most of my friends are. I won't say gruff, but they're direct, and they're not afraid. Most of my friends, and so Pierre, a lot of people, you know, are a little put off by Pierre because of his gruffness, but he's just like most of my other friends, right? And if you're looking for an opinion, right, he'll give it to you. And you might not particularly care what you hear, So Pierre and I have been good friends for a long time. But again, sitting there, and I called him after on Wednesday, and we talked, and I said, I wish you could have seen it. You'd have been button popping proud of your son, touching people's lives. And standing up there and talking about his own struggles and that if he could do it, they could do it. And what they were going to see today. And so it was awesome. It was absolutely positively awesome. So good stuff. Good stuff at Colorado Springs from North Dakota boy. So
good for you.
Yeah. So it was awesome. All right. So did you do anything exciting this week before we talk about food?
Well, I worked in my man cage.
Your hippie
on some leather on my leather project.
Your hippie man cage.
My little hippie man cage, and had some good thoughts every time I finished a keychain or whatever I was working on, had a good thought about you and what you asked me the other last week.
What did I ask you?
How important your pen was to you.
Oh,
and how
yeah.
You
no.
picked it up.
Right. You do that for people.
And, Yeah. And I felt real good. I felt real good about that. And then I moved on to the next project. But I spent a little bit of time down in the cage. That's what my wife calls it, my man cage. She tells everybody she locks me in there when she leaves the house.
Probably not a bad idea.
It's a very good idea.
Yeah, there you go. Everybody should have like a man cage that you can go to and hang out.
Oh yeah. Some place where you can go and think about things and work on projects and have a little quiet time or alone time or crank up the music time.
Yeah, mostly that.
Mostly that, which is mostly what I do. I've got a little speaker that I hook into my Spotify, and it's just blasting. Everybody comes in and gets off the elevator. It's right by the elevator, my cage. Oh, Kim's in the house.
That's right.
So yeah.
All right, I want to give you. I saw a story, yes. And you used to live in the Bay Area. San Francisco is rewriting language used to describe people that whether they be juvenile delinquents or drug abusers, convicted drug abusers or felons. And I want to get your thoughts on it. All right. Here's the old term. Convicted felon, right, / offender released from jail. Now, formerly incarcerated person, justice-involved person, returning resident. Okay? So no longer convicted felon. Now we're going to call them formerly incarcerated person or a justice-involved person or a returning resident. Juvenile delinquent, that's what you were known as. I was never tagged with that because I was a good kid. But juvenile delinquent, now we're going to call them young person with justice system involvement or young person impacted by juvenile justice system. And drug addicts, and substance abusers, a person with a history of substance abuse. So give me your thoughts. Is that like... Are we once again losing our minds, or is this like, no, this is...
It sounds like we're getting so PC, I want to throw up. But I understand that change the terminology a little bit, so when people come out of those kind of situations, that they've got a leg up, if they've made an effort to try to get a leg up. Otherwise, they'll be back in the slammer or wherever it is no time.
We don't call it the slammer. We call it the...
correctional facility.
No. We call it a justice system lodging facility.
Jesus, stop it.
What? What are we going to do? Call it a jail? But you know.
Yes. First of all.
Justice System Dormitory at San Quentin.
Yeah. No, they call it the Big Q. San Quentin. And if you're going to the Q, you're in deep kimchi.
Yeah, tell me about it.
And if you got out of the queue...
We're not going to call it that anymore. It's a justice system dormitory. Okay.
Well, I'm
how can you
sure...
Be, how can you be so butch and a hippie at the same time?
Look, there...
Come on, man.
I am who I am. Just speaking the truth, you can't flower shit over. You have to explain yourself. You shouldn't have to explain yourself. I mean, it is what it is.
No, it's not what it is.
If you're incarcerated and you get out and you've made an effort while you were in, though they don't make it easy for you to get rehabilitated in this jail. They're just holding you.
Well, and I don't agree with that. I think because I went down this road when who was the guy in Grand Forks? Alfonso Rodriguez murdered a University of North Dakota student, and he never participated in any of the offender treatment programs or any of the rehabilitation stuff. He decided not to do that, and so I had somebody on who was talking about, you know, the opportunities that you have when you're incarcerated if you want to go to those things. And they said most people that are violent offenders don't, but the ones that want to turn their life around do. And so I think your point is if you're trying, people are helping.
Yes, exactly.
That's my experience.
But you got yourself in this shithole.
Right.
If you make the effort to get out of it and you realize the wrongs you've committed, and sometimes they're so terrible, there is no way you're going to get out. It's called the death penalty.
Well, we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about
if you have a chance to rehabilitate yourself, and you do, and you get out, then you should be able to say, "Yeah, I got rehabilitated, and I've changed my life, and I've turned it around, and here I am, baby. Now, society, don't hold that shit against me. I'm a different person now than when I went in."
But again, Kim, you used to take guys that had been in jail, guys who, you know, were, you know,
I cherish guys that had troubled past.
Right.
That I could possibly help. Yes, I did.
And so my own opinion is what I think that little statement is if you're trying, people will help. That's the way Americans are. But
yeah, we should be.
Right. But the second half of that is don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. And so I don't care if you've been imprisoned, right, in a prison for a felony, or you stayed in a Justice Department dormitory at San Quentin. Either one doesn't mean shit to me. What matters is how you handle your business. And if you're trying hard, I'm helping. If you're going to piss down my back and tell me it's raining, I got no time for you. I have less than no time for you because I'm giving you a chance. I'm giving you a chance.
When you give somebody a chance, and like you say, they're doing the two step and peeing down your back, that's even worse to me. That's messing up an opportunity that's been handed to you again to rehabilitate yourself. So yes, you don't have any time for that. You got to just say sorry. You missed the boat. See you next time, maybe, or maybe not. Is that too butch?
That is pretty butch. I'm not gonna lie, especially coming from a hippie. You have these like these different people that you are, and so it's moderately interesting as you kind of travel the crooked ground of a conservative hippie.
Yeah, that, I guess you could say that. But you know, when you're raised properly like we were, and you're open person, you pretty much try or do anything at least once, and you go down a path for a little bit and you go, whoops, I shouldn't be here. I better change direction. That's because you've had the proper upbringing. However, there are many people that aren't as fortunate as we have been. But to recognize that and to make your corrections, that's a good thing. But not to try something is, I don't know. I think you gotta step out there once in a while and test the waters. It's just the way I have my whole life.
Right. I don't. And again, just to conclude this little discussion, I don't think it matters what you call the justice dormitory facility at San Quentin. Okay. What matters is, because at some point, you know, so Kim walks in. I'm like, "Hi, buddy." And he says, "I'd like to be one of your dishwashers." And I say, "Okay, well, let me get you an application, fill that out." And then I look and say, "Oh, you were in the justice dormitory at San Quentin?" And at some point, you know, he looks at me and says, "Yeah." And I give him a chance. It doesn't matter. You know, at the end of the day, right, somebody who's going to hire you is going to pull the string. They should.
Yeah.
And if they don't pull the string, you probably don't want to work there. But so you either live or you don't live by your actions and what you are. And so anyway, it's kind of humorous in terms of we're like, talk about PC run amok.
That's what I think it is.
Got it.
PC run amok.
Do you think that we should buy Greenland or Iceland? I can never remember which one.
Oh, God, that's a funny, funny thing.
I think we should. Why wouldn't we?
No, you don't buy it, you invade it, for Christ's sakes.
No.
You're Trump.
No.
Turn on the dogs, baby.
No.
That's what we need. Another island that we don't take care of after something happens tragic to it. They can take care of it themselves, like Puerto Rico, for example.
We're not good.
Even handle our own country, let alone buy or conquer or trade cheat.
We don't want to do anything.
Country.
All we want to do is buy it.
I don't.
Like we bought Long Island, didn't we? For like six necklaces and a couple of turkeys.
I know where you're going with this, but I just got to laugh. Yeah, like we got business being in Greenland. Why?
Condominiums.
Baby.
We could put some.
I mean, nice beach resort.
We could put
for
some
2 weeks a year.
military bases up there. But I don't know.
Greenland
is the one that's always cold, and Iceland is the one that's nice. I read something like that, but I don't rightly know. But
Iceland's great.
If we could buy Long Island, like why not? Why not? The how much was what was the price of Long Island? Do you recall?
Yes, I do. It was some trade beads.
You don't.
Yeah, I do. They bought it for some trinkets and beads from the Native Americans. That's what they bought Long Island for, or Manhattan for. Yeah.
Is it Manhattan or Long Island? They got a good deal.
What?
In one 1626 account, Peter Minuit, appointed general director of the New Netherland by the Dutch West Company.
Yeah, Dutch West Indies Company.
Oh, it's Manhattan, not Long Island. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it was Manhattan. Yeah.
Manhattan.
I corrected you.
Thank you very much. One of the most persistent myths in American history is that European explorers really got one over on the Native Americans by purchasing the entire island of Manhattan, where property has averaged $1,000 per square foot over the last few years, for a measly $24 worth of beads and trinkets. It seems like the ultimate bargain, but the truth of the story is more complicated and murkier than that.
Yeah.
Now, it has to do with
no doubt
West India Dutch companies. The guy who's writing in his diary, they could have purchased the island of Manhattan from the savages for the value of 60 guilders. There's a surviving deed for Manhattan and Long Island, but this was made well after the initial Manhattan purchase, when the Dutch had already been inhabiting the island for several decades. 19th century historians converted those 60 guilders to U.S. dollars and got what was $24. That same figure has been repeated for almost two centuries since, frozen in time and untouched by changes to the value of currency. But those guilders don't stand for $24 today. According to a converter from the International Institute of Social History at the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences, 60 guilders in 1626 is equivalent to 734.77 euros in 2011. The exchange rate to the U.S. dollar varies, but a conversion, as I'm writing this, gets you $951 U.S., which puts, I'm thinking, that's still not a very good deal by anybody's standards. So, wow. Wow. So maybe they did, if that came out of somebody's diaries.
Yeah.
What do you think of the greatest myths in American history?
Oh, God. Greatest myth?
Greatest? 10 American myths you probably believe.
Well, that would be one of them.
Paul Revere's Midnight Ride. Well,
yes, didn't that's he, right.
Didn't he do that?
And no, he did not, did he? I'm sure. I just saw.
It's one of
on
the
TV
most
where...
iconic scenes of the American Revolution. The image of Paul Revere on horseback shouting the British are coming.
Yeah.
But no, that image has little to do with American history. In fact, the valiant Paul Revere on horseback can only be found in a famous poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Truth be told, Revere's ride wasn't a big deal in his own time. It wasn't even mentioned in his obituary. For starters, he didn't do it alone. As he went along his route, he was joined by several others who helped him warn the arriving British forces. We know of at least two other men who accompanied him, Samuel Prescott and William Dawes.
It was a relay.
Number two, Betsy Ross and the American flag.
Yes.
It should be noted that during her time, Ross herself never claimed responsibility for the feat of making the American flag, with 13 stars arranged in a circle. According to Betsy, her contributions involved selecting a five-pointed star over a six-pointed one because they were easier to make. The concept of Ross creating the flag came 35 years after her death. Like all good myths, right? They don't start, right? They don't start.
Yes.
Now, number three, Ben Franklin and the national bird. Now, the national bird is a turkey, right? Oh, no.
Yeah, it was. It's an eagle now, but it was a turkey.
The Great Seal of America was chosen in 1782 with the bald eagle front and center. Since then, a rumor has persisted that Benjamin Franklin actually wanted the wild turkey to become the national bird. And there is actually some truth to the story. Franklin thought that the design for the eagle in the original seal looked more like a turkey. He then proceeded to compare the two. Franklin didn't like the bald eagle, considered it a bird of bad moral character for its tendency to steal food from other birds. He thought that by comparison, the turkey was a more courageous and respectable bird, despite looking a little vain and silly. So it's true that Franklin preferred the turkey over the eagle. However, his opinion was never made public. He simply wrote it in a letter to his daughter. He did make an official suggestion for the seal, though, a scene between Moses and Pharaoh.
I'll be darned.
How about that?
That's cool.
That's very cool. The cowboy hat is one of the most iconic images in American history. But that doesn't mean that our understanding of it isn't flawed. The iconic cowboy hat, the Stetson, might be what every cowboy wears in Westerns, but it wasn't what was actually worn in real life until the very end of the Wild Wild West. The Stetson wasn't even around until 1865. And in fact, it became really popular at the end of the 19th century. Up until then, You can clearly see from famous images of the Wild Bunch pictured above which hat cowboys preferred. The Derby, also known as the Bowler.
Yes.
The sombrero was also quite popular, but a gentleman might have preferred a top hat. How about
that?
The cowboy hat? The Wild Bunch wore derbies? And here they are, all five of them.
Yep, in derbies. Yeah.
Woo. How about Houston? We have a problem.
Yeah, but how about Houston? We don't have a hat.
Right.
That's great. Well, I tell you, it's myths how they started and the reality of it are fascinating.
Here's another one, War of the Worlds, right? We've all heard the story of how Orson Welles once did a radio show, you know, called War of the Worlds. Supposedly people thought
scared
it was
real. Scared the hell out of everybody.
And that the Earth was actually being invaded. Well, there is some truth to that. Some people did mistake the show as a genuine report. But the extent of the problem was greatly exaggerated because not that many people were listening to the show in the first place. The broadcast didn't have a large audience, and it was a very competitive time slot going up against much more popular shows on larger networks. Furthermore, several CBS affiliates chose to replace the broadcast when it was originally aired. So there wasn't mass panic, as I've been led to believe, all these years. How about Wall Street suicides in 1929?
The people were just flying out of windows in Wall Street. That's a myth.
This is more or less a myth. The suicide rate for New York in the months following the crash of the stock market went down, which is quite common after a tragic event.
Yep.
What? I thought they were jumping out of skyscrapers in Manhattan.
I did. I sure bought into that. When I was a little kid and they were talking about the crash of 29, oh yeah, Wall Street, everybody lost everything. They just jumped out windows.
They jumped out the window.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Yeah. That seems kind of stupid.
But whatever.
Hey. Yeah, how much did you lose? Yeah. Oh.
I lost everything.
Everything.
I lost everything. I'm out. Signing of the Declaration of Independence. What? Every year, Americans celebrate Independence Day on July 4th, the day the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence. But this is politics. Nothing gets solved in just one day. July 4th is actually the date when the Declaration was ratified. The process of signing it, right?
Took 2 years, didn't it?
No, it started on July 1st. When the Second Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia, over the course of the next few days, were spent going over the original draft, subsequent drafts, as written by Thomas Jefferson. Eventually, the Declaration was signed on August 2nd. Five delegates actually signed it at a later date. Two never signed it at all. And that's when John Hancock said, what font should I write this in? Oh, that's right, the fuck you font. Here you go. John Hancock. What font is that in? Oh, that would be the fuck you font, your Royal Highness. Oh, I've never seen that one before. No, neither have we. who is this Hancock asshole? Go find him. He knew that this was coming to me and signed it like that? Yes, sire. That's why we call it the fuck you font. Do you think he knows I'm the king? Oh, we all think he does. Damn it. Now, go find his ass for me. I got to yoke him up. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, August. The pilgrim look. Oh, now the cowboy look got shot down. Now the pilgrim look. The pilgrim look, the stupid hat, the buckles on the shoes, the thing around your neck, that doesn't look like a very comfortable way to roll around. So what did they dress like? They came from England, so they dressed in Elizabethan clothes, common in that era. Records from the Mayflower, such as wills and cargo logs, give us a good idea of pilgrim fashion. They liked colorful clothing and brought dyes with them to the New World. They also didn't wear buckles. What? Because they were an expensive accessory. Laces were cheaper and more readily available. Well, hell, man. There's all the Thanksgiving costumes. Who knew that? All right, here's the last one. Abner Doubleday in baseball. Abner Doubleday was a general in the Union Army, and he invented baseball. No?
No.
Abner Doubleday is routinely touted as the inventor of baseball, but there is little, if any, historical evidence to back the claim. Much like Betsy Ross and the flag, Doubleday had a good story, which trounced the truth. When baseball started getting really popular, there was actually a committee called the Mills Commission, organized with the purpose of tracking down the origins of the sport. One of the men in the commission, Albert Spaulding, hated that baseball was seen as a variation of the English game of rounders. He wanted the new beloved pastime to be 100% American, and Doubleday's story fit the bill perfectly. Here we have a decorated Civil War general who created the sport in his youth, living in a small town in New York. It was perfect. Good Lord. Really?
Oh, I'm crushed.
I know.
All by myth.
Oh, my, exactly. If you can't believe in a good myth.
Have been destroyed this morning.
Been destroyed. You know what? I was expecting the whole Manhattan thing to be like, $2 million in today's money. And you would be able to say, oh, well, you know, that's not a bad deal. You know, they got a couple million out of it. It was just a wilderness island.
Yes.
A big rock. Yeah, $900 is not. I don't know who he's driving that boat, but that was not really. That's not a lot of jack. All right, I've got a couple of questions that were sent to me during the week. One's about bread. Mac, yes. I heard you talking about the bread the chef served at his restaurant. Did he ever do anything like buttered garlic French bread that he would put in the oven and serve with any dishes? I love bread. I love it with butter and garlic on it. Is there any recommendations he can give me? I've seen people put a little bit of cheese on it, yada, 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 paprika for presentation factor. And then in parentheses, I learned that from you guys. What would he recommend? So I don't recall having any kind of garlic bread, as I would call it, with a meal at your joint. Did you serve any?
Only upon special request. I would take my French bread. I would cut it lengthwise. And then I'd make slits in each half about 2 inches apart, and I'd take the serrated edge and cut down about 3/4 of the way. I wouldn't cut all the way through.
Okay.
And then I would lather it. Usually I would have garlic puree that it was heavy on the oil, you know, like a paste, but thinner.
Right.
And I spread that all over the bread and try and get it in the little slice sections.
Oh, we love that.
Yeah, we love that. And then I would take some Parmesan cheese, finely, not too finely grated. Okay, you didn't want a powder, but you wanted small grades of Parmesan cheese. I'd heavily dose that so it would stick to the bread,
right?
Because there's garlic oil, and then I would top it with paprika and a little, and then throw it in the oven for about three minutes till the cheese gets kind of golden, crusty brown. Maybe 5 minutes, depends on how much cheese you throw on.
And then can I make a comment here?
Yes.
I will tell you this, because I make great garlic bread, and I don't, my mother, I do my mother's. This may surprise everybody. It's Kathleen's stuff. But you cannot be, like, bombing around the kitchen while you're doing this, because the key to great, I think, garlic bread is, one, don't skimp on the butter. I mean, when you're eating that, like if you've got like a ribeye steak and salad, and you have a piece of good like garlic bread like that, and you bite into it, and there's a lot of butter. Oh my God, that's to die for.
It's running down your chin.
Right, that's to die for. And but the thing is this: when you put it in the oven, normally, you know, the way she would do it is she would put it in the oven on the low part of the oven with the broiler on.
Yeah.
And so she would let the butter melt into the bread, let the bread heat up and all that. And then she would raise the rack, and then she would brown it lightly. But the key part is, and you're not putting it right under the broiler, but the key part is you got to stand there and watch it, because nothing sucks more than when somebody destroys the bread. And all you want is a little golden on that stuff, and it's to die for. But you got to position somebody at the oven and say, you've got to watch this. It's your only job here. You have no other job. And if you do that, the bread turns out great. And it's a great addition to the meal, I think.
Well, I think it's the key to the highway to a good meal.
Talk to me about
garlic
bread. Yeah, so I used
and
to
then
use... what kind of... So Parmesan cheese, talk to me. I would just use the ghetto-ass Kraft stuff that comes out of the green thing.
The green cardboard
tube. I use that, and let me tell you, delicious. But I've seen other people get like real Parmesan, right, cheese, and they sprinkle that on liberally. Not liberally. They don't coat it if they use real cheese. If they use the shake on stuff, they'll coat it. But if they use the real cheese, they won't do as much. Do you have a preference in terms of your taste?
Yeah, I like the real cheese.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because it's just a better grade of cheese.
Right. No.
It's going to make a different bread, but it's not better or worse than the green tube. It's a preference, and that's all it is. And it's a lot cheaper to use the Kraft in the container. You can put a lot more cheese on there. You have a little more control over it. But and when you before you put it in, you do your paprika on top. That melts into the mixture, turns it a little golden red. And then when it comes out, you have finely chopped parsley that you just sprinkle over the bread, and the heat from the cheese and the butter or olive oil or garlic, however combination you use, will kind of suck that parsley in. And not only is it delicious, but it's real pretty. And I appeal to food is important.
When you say I appeal, you mean EYE, not I.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. EYE appeal.
There you go.
that's part of its, you know, oh, God, that looks so good. I can't wait to dive into that.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah.
The problem, there's only one problem with garlic bread.
Never enough.
Is there's never enough, and am I going to get my share?
That's
and,
the word.
And I can eat a lot of garlic bread. It's been proven.
No. You know what? Let me tell you, and what's bad is when your kids start getting older, and when they're little, they don't eat that stuff, right? And then they get bigger, and, like, you order stuffed mushrooms, and you got a half a stuffed mushroom, and you look like, what just happened? I just paid $15 for stuffed mushrooms. You got a half a mushroom, and then your dumbass sons are looking at you like,
what's the problem?
Yeah,
they're good.
How many? You
taught us to love them, Dad.
And then they do, and then you're like,
but I also taught you to share, kid.
Oh, sorry about that. My bad. Here's another kind of a seasonal message. Hey, Mac. In the spirit of screwing with food, I was wondering if the chef has any suggestions about what to throw in deviled egg mix to make a deviled egg something a whole lot more than just a standard deviled egg, which I love. So you and I both love deviled eggs, but
yes.
Is there anything that you would throw in the mix? Because I hadn't really thought of that. You could put a whole bunch of stuff in there to make the very
first thing that comes to mind, Mac, one word,
bacon,
and what you do with the bacon is you crisp it up and then you dice it up, so you have these little flecks of bacon, so every bite has a little hit of bacon in there. And if you like heat, my preference is sriracha. You don't want to overdose on the sriracha. You want some heat, a little subheat to that egg and mayonnaise, and you can use shallots or onions. I like to mince red onions and deviled eggs, and then put in, if you really want to get it hotsy-totsy, a little shot of pickle relish. But always, always, folks, add bacon. But that's just my preference. Because I like as many of the food groups in an egg as I possibly can.
The problem, though, is you only have a small place to put that in. So then you got to kind of pile it on the outside, and
you mound it.
Right. Well, you know, one of the, I think Kim taught me this about something else, which is before you put it in on the egg, give it some time in the refrigerator, which firms it up. Which means you could stack more. You can stack more of it on there, as opposed to when it's a little bit warmer and kind of mushier. Get it firmer and then pile that stuff on. These are like fat guy food rules, okay? Which I always find hilarious.
And the thing is, if you let your egg mix, your yolk mixture, yolk, mayonnaise, a little bacon or green onion or red onion, sriracha, pickle relish, a little pepper, black pepper. If you have bacon in there, you don't need salt. And you let that mixture sit in a bowl, whether it's ceramic or stainless steel. Don't let it sit in plastic, because that has a tendency to suck whatever's been in that plastic dish. But you let it sit in the fridge for at least an hour to firm up and all the flavors to blend. It makes it even a better egg, and it also, like Mac just said, When you take that teaspoon and you're piling it inside the little half an egg hole, you can pile it like a mound and it stays there. And then you can set them on trays or however. They have these ceramic dishes that hold devil's eggs, deviled eggs. And you can buy them in any food store. And they have up to a dozen. Well, I quite frankly can eat a dozen deviled eggs myself. But I'm a gentleman. I will contain myself, to no more than, three.
Yeah, and just some health advice. Do not get between Kim and the deviled eggs. You may get injured. Because he...
You might lose a finger. That's all.
That's all. So it's not going to be a substantial injury.
Just a finger. And it's usually a pinky. Because that's the finger that everybody should not hold up in the air, but usually do. And that's right in the flight pattern of my mouth heading for the egg. So... Therein lies the trouble for you, not me. I'm gonna get my egg.
No kidding. No, it's a summer kind of deal, right? I mean, you associate deviled eggs with picnics and things like that. So
yes, you do.
So no, that's a good question. A little bit of breaking news this morning. U.S. officials have confirmed that Israel was responsible for the bombing of an Iranian weapons depot in Iraq last month, an attack that would mark a significant escalation in Israel's years-long campaign against the Iranian military and their entrenchment in the region. The confirmation comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is strongly hinting that his country is behind recent airstrikes in Iraq. So there was an article, I was doing the news earlier today, talking about this Iraqi militia commander saying that Israel was behind all of it. And I said, well, look, I don't know anything about it, but that's the standard refrain, right? Israel's behind everything. But if that's the truth, and it's interesting, all this dancing with Iran, just know this, Israel's, the music they dance to is very short, right? So the United States will dance for long periods. Israel does not dance for very long periods of time.
No. If they react.
Yeah, if Iran is close to getting a nuclear weapon, you will see the United States will be informed that Israeli warplanes are in the air. That's the way that'll happen, and they will not ask for permission. So very, very interesting. All right, any big plans for the weekend?
Not really. I'm going to. Just hang out with my wife. We have Chad and Jill Kaya coming, and we're working on a menu for them. They're local, they're next-door neighbors, and I have a nice big porterhouse and some Alaskan scallops, and we're just putting them all together.
Oh, I know. There's one more question before you go. Somebody said, hey, will you ask him at some point, why bone in as opposed to bone out in any steak? He said, I've heard people talk that always buy bone-in steaks. Why?
Well, it helps the flavor of the steak. The marrow and whatnot in the bone flavors the steak. When I have a leftover bone, not only do I strip it down, I will throw it in a pot of water with some carrot, celery, onion, parsley. Here we go again with parsley. And I would cook it down for about an hour and extract all the flavor out of that bone. And I have a little stock, and I reduce that by half. And then I have a little start of a stock for a beef sauce. If I'm going to do some kind of like a peppercorn steak sauce. That's kind of my start for it.
Got it. All right. But bottom line, it's a flavor decision.
Yes, it is. It's a flavor decision. And whether it's a pork chop, a veal chop, or a T-bone, or a ribeye bone in, I love gnawing on bones.
Colleen. Come here and say goodbye to everybody. This is my lovely daughter, Colleen, getting ready to go to play volleyball. No, she's going to do something. I don't really know what I'm supposed to because she told me. But I've forgotten. But Annika's picking her up. And you want to say goodbye to Kim and say goodbye to everybody. Colleen turns 16 on Monday.
Sweet 16, baby.
And I'm...
Congratulations, Colleen.
And I'm not even going to be here. So you want to say goodbye? Say hi to Kim and goodbye to everybody else.
Hi, Kim. Bye, everybody.
Yeah. Have a great weekend, Colleen.
Say it like you've been
and
on the radio.
Birthday.
Say it like you've been on the radio before, for God's sake.
I have.
Come here. Say it.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Exactly. She's going to get beaten. See ya. I'll see you tonight. I'll see you at your game. Yes. Go ahead.
You have a great weekend yourself. Where are you headed now?
Headed down to San Clemente here. And going to do my little post-traumatic winning thing for 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. So do that. And then on Sunday I fly to North Carolina. I'll be back there all week doing preaching the gospel, man. Preaching the gospel. That you can do it.
As you should, my man.
Let me tell you. My friend that we talked about at the start of the show, Bob Nielsen, he's an example of it, right? You come back from Vietnam and the isolation that people went through and nobody wants to talk to you and you don't say anything about it, right? You just, what he's done his whole life is he's helped people. And it's in the helping of others that we restore ourselves, we help ourselves to find a place that we didn't even know existed when this shit originally enters our life. And that's what he's done. And he's a great example of what post-traumatic winning is. You can't do anything about the bad shit that gets into your life.
No, you can't.
You can't medicate it to a good place. You can't talk it to a good place. Okay? But if you use those experiences to help others, right? And you transform other people.
That makes all the difference.
And you help them, you help yourself, man. It's the Grinch moment when he hears the Who people sing. And your heart grows. And I have that happen to me every day, and it's going to happen again today and all next week. And that's why I'm one of the coolest son of a bitches on the planet, is because that's what fills my day. And what I tell people is, it can fill your day too. Because I'm going to tell you what I do. I'm going to tell you what I know.
It's huge. It's huge, Mac, what you bring to the table.
Well, no, but I mean, you're doing, just the work with your leather and... Right? And giving a gift to somebody. Right?
Yes.
And I would even tell you that you should put something in there, some little words of happiness in there. So they not only have something that you made, but also are the beneficiaries of your wisdom, too, and the way you've lived your life.
That's a great call, Mac.
Right. So as you,
I will do that.
Yeah, you not only touch somebody with a piece of leather, but you touch them with your spirit, and that spirit lives forever. So, no, but it's the better way that you live your life. It's the better way that you live your life, and so that's what I do. And Bob's a great example of it, and so thank you.
I can't wait to meet him.
All right, well, I will hook you two up, all right?
All right.
Then you could be like cooking dudes together, so anyway.
That's, I'm all over it.
All right,
thank you, Mac.
Yeah, have a great day.
Have a wonderful weekend.
You bet.
Good luck today.
Thank you.
There you have it.
The one and only, P. Kimball Holmes. Van Morrison, but we don't play that song going out the door. We play this song. Good to be home. I'm headed out the door here in the not too distant future. Well, again, if you're just tuning in, you're going to hear me talk about the Congressional Medal of Honor Society honored Bob Nielsen. And, you know, you're going to hear in the first hour me talk a little bit about that. And also having the opportunity to interview General Zinni yesterday for about almost 3 hours. Yeah, talk about, like, dying and going to heaven. Talking to smart, funny guys with great experience. And him very generous with his time. So you'll hear that next week. It's awesome, though. It is. He's again, for me, he's the epitome, or the epitome, whichever you prefer, of what it is to be a stand-up person and tell the truth. In a lot of time, telling the truth at levels of government where they don't do the truth. And he did. He didn't play the game. So anyway, yeah, I got a chance to do that. I'll talk about that a little bit. But have a great weekend. All next week from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Fired up for that. So don't be afraid to live the high life. And you can do that a little bit every day by touching people's lives. So download those 3 goals and 9 commandments to your phone and forget about them. And I promise you, you'll change somebody's life in the next month. I promise you. You can't avoid, there's too much of it around you. So, on a Friday, All Marine Radio is over and out.